that I wasn't able, for the folks in Ohio, scanner isn't working on my computer, so I wasn't able to scan the notes to you guys. Try to really go through it in a way to follow along. I actually had done some research quite a few years ago on looking at a topic on covenant, and I was originally going to do a study on that when I was actually up in St. Catharines, and before I was ever able to give that study, I actually was fired, for lack of a better job, for my views on universalism, so I never got to present it, and I kind of stuck it away. And the other day when I was going through this area in Exodus, I came across a lot of these notes again, and I figured, hey, this really fits in well with what we're talking about, and I thought it would be a good idea to actually present the lost study, for lack of a better term. What I really want to look at is there is a formula that the Old Testament will consistently present when it's dealing with the idea of a covenant or a treaty, depending where you are in Scripture. Obviously, we want to focus on the idea of covenant, and I wanted to keep it in that regard, just looking at three different passages in some detail. The first passage is Exodus 20, in another hand, maybe, or if you want to put a marker there, you could take Deuteronomy chapter 1, and then a second marker in Joshua chapter 24. Those are the three passages, to some degree, I wanted to look at. I think again, when we look at these things, the Word of God actually has a lot to say about a lot of different topics that sometimes we just don't think that God's really, we don't oftentimes look at some of the things, and we shortchange ourselves. And one of the things we should always endeavor to do is to try to know what God is saying about any subject and really get into it. And remember last week we had mentioned that Deuteronomy and the way the law is laid out in Deuteronomy is different than the way God is presenting it in this part of Exodus. And I think you'll be able to see it from what I'm going through tonight. You'll see why I'm saying that. But there actually is a specific order in how a covenant would be given and how it would be laid out. And the first thing you're going to have in that order is an introduction of the speaker. It's important in that sense because we have to know who's proposing the covenant. And the very beginning part of any covenant that's going to be laid out in Scripture is that there's an introduction of who's speaking. For instance, if you look at Exodus chapter 20, in verse number 1, somebody could read that.
I am Yahweh,
So we begin chapter 20 with Elohim speaking some words. So we're introduced right away to who the speaker is. And who's the speaker?
Elohim.
So we know that the covenant is going to be proposed by him. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 1, keep your hand back there in Exodus. And we'll look at the first five verses. I'll read verse 1 and we can kind of read around. Deuteronomy 1, verse 1. Let everybody get there. Deuteronomy chapter number 1 and verse number 1. These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel in the Transjordanian wastelands the arid country opposite south between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazareth, and Dizahab.
It takes 11 days to travel from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea via Mount Seir.
And it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to Yahweh and given him the commandment to them.
After he had slain Sihon, the king of Amorites, which dwelt in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, which dwelt in Ashtaroth and Edrei, he told one of the transports in the land.
Okay, so we have an introduction of a speaker here in Deuteronomy 1. Who's the speaker?
Moses.
So that's a different person now that's coming forth proposing something. That's one of the differences that you have between Exodus 20 and what's being given in the law in Deuteronomy. In Exodus 20, it's God speaking directly to the nation. And it's interesting because later on in Exodus 20, at the very end, remember, they're terrified and they'd rather have Moses speak to them, right? But in Deuteronomy, it's Moses who's speaking. Moses is now presenting a covenant to the nation of Israel, where in Exodus 20, it was God himself who's presenting a covenant to the nation of Israel. If you go to Joshua chapter 24, in the first two verses in Joshua 24, we'll pick up with Cindy then.
Joshua 24, verse 1 and then verse 2. And Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel before their heads for discussion for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said unto all the people, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the Jordan at that time, he was Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Abraham, and he served from his God.
Okay, so here in Joshua chapter 24, I do want to make one little side note. When it talks about old time in the King James, that's the word olam, that the King James oftentimes will translate as forever. Or have some kind of timeless quality to it. There they got it right. It has a time element. Rotherham uses age past times. But the speaker here?
Joshua.
And what's Joshua doing? He's relaying some information that came from who? From God. So Joshua is going to be proposing something here. In the book of Joshua. And again, he's being introduced as the speaker. He's the one presenting something to the nation. So you have the formula. It begins with an introduction of the speaker. The second part of it will be a historical prologue. Now, what do I mean by a historical prologue? It would be basically taking a look back at past history.
The backstory,
right, to give a survey of past relationships that the two sides have had together. For instance, God could look back on it and relate to Israel their history together. And he does that. For instance, remember when Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address? One of the things... Well, none of us remember it. Darn, keep away my age again. None of us remember it, right? That was a bad choice of words, wasn't it? Third one for Lil. Remember studying about... That's a better way to phrase it. Well, one of the things, though, that he did in that speech is he went back and gave a historical accounting of what brought the country up to that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
He did the same with the second inaugural address when he was proposing, because it was up very easy to see that the war was going to be over within a couple of months at most. And at the time, he was trying to lay out how to bring the South back into the Union in the second inauguration address. And what he laid out is how they got to that point and what led to that point, and then the answer to fixing it. So he reviewed the relationship between the two parties. Well, God does that too. And in Exodus chapter 20, in verse number 2, God's going to lay out a historical relationship between him and Israel. And here's where their history begins in his thinking. I am Yahweh, verse 2 of Exodus 20, I am Yahweh, your Elohim, who has brought you out from the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. In other words, what's the historical perspective of God with Israel and his dealing with them up to this point? Well, you've had a long period of silence, right? And then God broke that silence, and how did he break the silence? By bringing them out of Egypt. So he recalls to them that bringing them out of the land of Egypt, but it also recalls their past history, because they can remember the fact on how they got into Egypt in the first place. So by saying that one line, he covers both present and past. I've brought you out of the house of Egypt, out of the land of Egypt. Then he refers to the land of Egypt as the house of bondage or the house of slavery. Depending on a translation, it'll be worded similar fashion to one of those phrases. So the idea is that God, as he's proposing this covenant to Israel, you have the introduction of the speaker, then you have the prologue. Go with me, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 1. We're not going to do all the reading here. This is quite lengthy. Deuteronomy chapter 1, yep. In Deuteronomy, though, just for the folks in Ohio, this historical prologue will go from Deuteronomy 1:6 all the way through chapter 3. In verse 29. So it's quite a lengthy retelling of the historical pattern, but just so we see a little bit of it, we'll read a few verses. Let's actually read the first verse 6 through 9, just to get a little bit of a flow.
The Lord spoke unto us in Horeb, saying, you have dwelt long enough in this mount, turn you, and take your journey, and go to the mount of the Amorites, and unto all the places nigh thereto, in the plain, in the hills, and in the valley, and in the south, and by the seaside, to the land of the Canaanites, and unto Lebanon, unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give unto them, and to their seed after them. And I spoke unto you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear myself alone.
Now it's interesting, because Moses here is recounting what Yahweh had said to him. So we have to understand, it's kind of an interesting address. It's God speaking, but he's speaking through the mouth of Moses. Everybody follow that idea? Because remember in verse 1, these are the words which Moses spoke, right? And what's he recounting? Verse 3, that Moses addressed the Israelis just as Yahweh had instructed him. So he's saying word for word verbatim what God had told him. Now, he begins here, and he goes back all the way back to the promises he made to Abraham. And in this address, dealing with the rest of chapter 1, all of chapter 2, and then into chapter 3, all the way to the end of chapter 3. So really, it's the majority, all of chapter 1 begins the idea of this covenant. And then you have the historical prologue, which begins in the 6th verse of chapter 1, and it will continue through chapter 2 and chapter 3. So it's a lengthy retelling of Israel's history. And he does get into a lot of detail about some things about their history. For instance, let's go down to verse 16. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 16, just so you can see.
And I charge your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother, and the foreigner that is with him.
See, now he's recounting the time frame when judges came into being. And this would be before the book of Judges.
Yeah.
So he's talking about the judges that came with when Jethro had talked to Moses and so on.
The 70.
Yeah. He's getting into some of those things. He's also going back and recounting a lot of things here. And he's letting them know about their history. For instance, he talks in verse 36 through 38, Caleb and Joshua, and how they recommended going into the land and so on. So you have all this retelling of their history before he gives the body of information he wants to give. If you go to Joshua, chapter 24, and again, this is a lot of reading, too. We'll just pick a few verses here. It really starts in verse 2, which we read. But in verse 2, Joshua had talked about some things that Yahweh was doing from age past times or of old times unto Abraham. So I'll pick up verse 3. So he took your father Abraham from beyond the river, led him through all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his seed, gave him unto Isaac, and gave unto Isaac Jacob and Esau. He gave unto Esau Mount Seir to possess it, but Jacob and his sons went down into Egypt. And he continues talking about the plagues in verse 5, and he's going to continue here speaking of Israel's history up through verse 13. He even gets into when they go out into the wilderness and they deal with Balak, and he talks about some of those things. He talks about Jericho, for instance. So he recounts a lot of information up to this point. So what you have is a historical prologue. Now, the question we could probably be asking ourselves at this point is, why is all this important? And I think it's important, one, God wants us to understand the source of the covenant, where it's coming from. And in all these cases, he's the originator, but the person proposing it might be different, because we see a change on how God deals with the nation. First, God deals with them directly. They can't handle that. They ask for an intercessor, and he allows Moses to be that intercessor. And from that point forward, Moses does intercede. So he's the go-between. Now, that would be very similar to, for instance, piggybacking something I was talking with Daryl earlier. Moses is an intercessor, but Jesus is an intercessor for man, isn't he? Yeah. So there's a likeness in that regard. Moses is speaking the words of Yahweh, and Jesus will come speaking the words of the Father. So you have that likeness of the two. That's why, for instance, in the Gospels, it will refer to the fact that there's a prophet coming like unto Moses. So to understand these exchanges gives us a little bit of an idea about the intercessory work of Jesus. be the new. He wants to replace that Sinaitic covenant with something new. He wanted to do that right there in Deuteronomy. And when they went into the land of Joshua, had they conquered land, he would have done that.
Where he was king.
That's right. But again, they reject it. And he can't establish it. And then we don't read of any of that other idea. In fact, that's what Joshua is beginning to propose at the end of the book of Joshua. I'm submitting that idea, and that's why we're looking at Joshua 24 briefly tonight. Because he's laying out some terms of a future contract with Israel. So you have that idea going on. He's laying out their history, though. This is what brought us to this point. This is why we're going to establish this in writing. And the reasoning for establishing it in Deuteronomy becomes quite lengthy because Israel's failed a lot. And God's establishing that the only thing that sustained them was him. You couldn't do it. You needed me. That's right. And it's the way God is. He always will pursue all of us because he loves us. And he wants a relationship with us. And he just won't give up. That's the beauty of it. He just will never give up. He loves us. And he wants that relationship. So you begin to see that. The next thing, let's go back to Exodus. Exodus 20. And in Exodus 20, the next thing that you're going to read in any contract or covenant that's being given is the stipulations of the contract or the covenant. Now, this is easy in Exodus 20, because we're dealing with the Ten Commandments, right? And really, the stipulations are the commandments, just so we can get a flow of them. Let's start here at verse 3, and we'll read down through... Let's read down through verse 17. Exodus 20, verse 3. We'll read around the room, though. I'll start. We'll read around the room, and we'll end at verse 17. Exodus 20, verse 3. You shall have no other gods besides me.
You shall not make to yourselves an image or any form that is in the heavens above, or that is in the land beneath, or that is in the waters underneath the ground.
You shall not bow down yourself to them, nor serve them, for I, Yahweh, your Elohim, am a jealous. Charging the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generation of them that are feeding me.
And shall be mercy to thousands of them that love me, and keep my commandments.
Six days shall you labor and do all your work.
And the seventh day is the Sabbath of Yahweh, your Elohim. In it you shall not do any work, you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your cattle, nor your sojourner who is within your gates.
For 6 days Yahweh made heaven, land, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. On account of this, Yahweh blessed the seventh day and hallowed it.
Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long on the land which Yahweh your Elohim gives it to you,
son. Thou shalt not kill.
You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his bull, nor his donkey, nor anything that belongs to your neighbor.
Thou shalt
verse 13, it's interesting. The King James will read kill.
Murder.
The idea there is to murder. Because there are times when God does command people to be killed. So murder is the idea there. It's the idiom. So right there you have the list of obligations. If we look at verse 22 here, verse 22, coming down through chapter 23 in verse 19, you're going to have a code, a covenant code that's going to be given. Just so you can see this, let me just read a few verses here. Verse 22. Yahweh said to Moses, "This is what you shall tell the children of Israel. You yourselves have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall most certainly not make alongside of me gods of silver or gods of gold for yourselves. An altar of soil you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stone for me, you must not build it of cut stones, because if you strike it with your chisel, you will profane it. And you must not go up by steps to my altar so that your nakedness is not exposed." And he then gets into verse 1. "Now these are the judgments which you shall place before them." And he goes down through a code of conduct with them. We call that code of conduct Israel's civil law. But he goes through a number of laws in a way that they're to conduct themselves. What he does is he lists his obligations with them. In chapter 34, he begins to address the rituals that they would have to do. And then in Leviticus chapter 1, going down through especially the first 7 chapters, he lays out the different sacrifices that they're obligated to perform. So you have all of that going on with the nation of Israel, and all that information is being given to her so that she knows what she's responsible for. So you have the introduction of the speaker. You have the historical prologue, or the retelling of their relationship together. And then you have the stipulations of the covenant that's going to be given. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 4, Deuteronomy chapter number 4, the stipulations of the Mosaic covenant here being given in Deuteronomy chapter 4 is going to be a very lengthy part of the book of Deuteronomy. It's going to go from chapter 4 all the way through chapter 26. Really, when you think about it, the whole book of Deuteronomy basically is the giving of the Mosaic law.
This is retelling.
Yep. He's going through what it is. So just so we see a little bit of it, though, in chapter number 4, let's look here at verse 13. And verse 13, let's read verse 13 and 14.
"He revealed to you the covenant he has commanded you to keep, the 10 commandments, writing them on 2 stone tablets. Moreover, at that same time, Yahweh commanded me to teach you statutes and ordinances for you to keep in the land which you are about to enter and possess."
So he comes back and he's telling them about the 2 tables of stone that he had and the 10 commandments that he gave. We have to remember there were 2 tables of stone and commandments that God gave. The first one God had wrote. Moses came down from the mountain, broke them, and he was angry. And the second one, Moses had to carve it out. It's the second one that Deuteronomy is the most concerned with. But again, he's going to reiterate all of the Ten Commandments here in this time frame, and he's going to get into that code of ethics that we began to look at in Exodus, and he's going to retell all of those things. And again, we're not going to sit here and read the entire book of Deuteronomy tonight to get through it, but there are those stipulations that are entailed within it. If you go to the book of Joshua, chapter 24, the stipulations he's going to lay out here basically will cover verses 14 through 25. That we can read a little bit. Verse 14. Now therefore, revere ye Yahweh, and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the Jordan, beyond the river, and in Egypt, and serve ye Yahweh. But if it be a vexation in your eyes to serve Yahweh, choose ye for yourselves today whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye are dwelling. But I and my house will serve Yahweh. Then responded the people and said, far be it from us that we should forsake Yahweh to serve other gods. For as for Yahweh our God, he brought up both us and our fathers out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of servants, and who did before our eyes these great signs, and preserved us throughout all the way wherein we journeyed, and among all the peoples through the midst of whom we passed. Then did Yahweh drive out all the peoples, even the Amorites who were dwelling in the land, from before us. We too will serve Yahweh, for he is our God. Then Joshua said unto the people, ye cannot serve Yahweh, for a holy God he is, a jealous God he is. He will not forgive your transgression, nor your sin. When ye forsake Yahweh and serve the gods of a stranger, then will he turn and inflict on you calamity and consume you, after that he hath dealt well with you. But the people said unto Joshua, nay, but Yahweh will we serve. It continues down. The whole point Joshua's getting at here, and the people begin to recount their history back to God, is the importance of serving Yahweh alone. And notice here, the only stipulation he really begins to lay out that personifies all of it is verse 14. Now therefore revere ye. I think Rotherham has that right. I think King James has it wrong. They have fear. And it's the same word that means things in the language. It means to be in awe, a trembling kind of an awe.
Respect.
Right. It's like having so much respect for somebody that you literally begin to shake and tremble in reverence when you're in front of that person. So what are they to do? They're to revere Yahweh and serve him how? In sincerity and in truth. That's the stipulation. All of the other things flow from that. Because if they had been sincere with it, God would have caused them to do it. But he's beginning here to lay out some of these things. Notice verse 25. So then Joshua solemnized a covenant for the people on that day, and set for them a statute and a regulation in Shechem. The covenant that Joshua is making is with the nation itself. They have agreed that they are going to revere only Yahweh and serve Yahweh in sincerity and in truth. The result of that is that God then is allowing the judges to be set up so that the nation can then begin to complete the conquest of the land. They fail to do so. They break their covenant to serve God in sincerity and truth and to revere him, and God can't usher in a replacement contract for the Mosaic. And in fact, he doesn't even address any such an idea again until he hit the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31. He begins to address that idea again with them. But you have that whole idea that Joshua is getting at here, is he's laying out the stipulations. What's the main stipulation there? To revere God, to serve him in sincerity, to serve him in truth. And you know, isn't that really all God has ever wanted to be? When you think about it, he's always wanted us to revere him, and he's always wanted man to serve him in sincerity and in truth.
It always comes back to us.
It does.
It's not just one way.
No. He wants us to respond. Wants us to respond positively towards him. And he does that. So again, it's interesting because you see that they build an altar there as well. Much like what happened in Exodus, and later on what happens in Deuteronomy, an altar is built to ratify that contract or covenant. I'll probably stop there, and we'll pick up with the last three parts next week. But I think it's important for us to understand it, because we get a little bit of an insight into God's mind when we see how he crafts these contracts with the nation of Israel. We get the importance of it. God is a God of his word. And when he gives his word, he'll do everything he said he will do. And he intends those that give their word to him to do the same. And that's why the consequences that are laid out under the Sinaitic and then later on the Mosaic contracts are and even the New Covenant are so tough. Because if somebody breaks his law in the New Covenant, what happens? But when they can't.
Right.
Because he's causing them to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he takes away that impossibility for them. But in the other contracts, it's an escalating punishment, and it can be severe, up to capital punishment. And that's why Exodus 20:13 should be murder and not kill. Because if it was kill, then God's breaking his own covenant. That's why that's a bad translation there.
But military school boot camp for delinquents. That's the whole thing.
It's a boot camp for delinquents, yeah.
That's what all these chapters are about. It's military boot camp for schools called delinquents.
And you know, it's interesting because Paul...
It's going on and on.
And when Paul talks about the law, he refers to it as a time when we were under tutors and governors. We were children, is the way he refers to it.
Yeah, they keep saying, sir, yes, sir, and then they turn around and...
Mess up. They're like... Well, Israel's like the Gomer pile of, you know, the military, if you want to look at it that way. But I think it's important to see the order on how God does things, the preciseness to it. There's nothing left to chance. He spells it out, and he leaves no doubt as to what he expects, and he leaves no doubt as to what the consequences will be if they break the covenant, and he leaves no doubt as to what the blessings will be if they keep the covenant. So it's not all negative, because there is a lot of blessings that are associated with the covenants as well. They just chose to unfortunately place themselves under curses more than blessings. But that was their own choice to do so, not God. God is just being true to his word on what he said he would do, one way or the other.
Well, here's the thing. The whole point, the law is a schoolmaster until we come to Christ. And that's the idea behind it. So much was granted to them, the blessings, because
because of what God was laying out. Even though it wasn't a reality, it was all in shadows at that time, but it was a picture of what he already knew was going to take place for the world.
But he wanted them to come to the aha moment.
That's right. Uh-huh. That was the whole purpose of it. Yeah. The purpose is exactly what Joshua said. It was to bring them to a point of reverence.
Yep.
To humble them. Yeah. To realize, you know what? I can't do it. Help me. That's all he wanted to hear.
But they never said it.
And they never said it. And unfortunately, there's a few people in history that have said it that are recorded for us. In the Gospels, you had the wonderful phrase, help my unbelief. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. So you have some people who do come to the end of themselves, but it's rare. Sometimes Israel gets to a point of where they realize they're in way over their head, and they'll cry out to God for deliverance.
Oh, there were individuals that had moments of it. David had lots of moments of it.
Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel was another one. David came to the point where he just said, I have accomplished these things because God was with me, and he will be with me when I fight this next battle.
And that's why God could look at David and say that David was a man like unto his own heart. It's not that David was perfect. It's that David revered God. And that is like his own heart. He reveres his holiness and sanctity. And David did likewise. And that's why he could say David was like a man unto his own heart. Not that David was perfect. He wasn't. He was far from it. But he had that reverential awe of who God was. And he relied on God throughout his life. I mean, sometimes he'd act irrationally and do something because he was impulsive, and it would get him into a lot of trouble, but he would trust that God would do right by him in whatever circumstance he was in. Sometimes he would complain to God, but God expects that. He wants to hear how you feel. What he really wants is that reverence, and Israel never gave it. They refused to allow themselves to be broken. What the law did, rather than humble them, they became proud and looked at it and became arrogant and said, look at what we have. No one else has it. And they exalted themselves rather than God. And rather than looking at it as a schoolmaster that would break them, they looked at it as something that made them greater than everybody else.
The edge of righteousness of their own.
Yep. Yep. And in fact, they were so arrogant that as hard and as difficult as God's law was, they made it even more difficult and harder by adding things into it that were never there. They added in their verbal traditions and things like that that Jesus comes along later on and really lambastes them for. They could never keep it.
They reverenced
the law. They did. They referenced their laws and what God was going to do with them, but they didn't reverence God. Probably a good point to break. Any other questions? Any questions?
Hey, Bill. Yeah. Earlier you said when they failed to revere God, as Joshua is bringing out in chapter 24, you mentioned something else after that in relation to the Mosaic Covenant, and I didn't quite hear that. Do you remember what you said?
You said, had they revered God, they would have finished the conquest of the land, and then he could have established a rule where he would have, I believe, set up the standing of the new covenant and brought it in. I think this was like a preamble to it, and he wanted to establish something, and he wanted to take them out of the mosaic and put them into something greater. But he could never get to that point with them because they just would never allow themselves to be broken.
So therefore they remained in the Mosaic covenant is what you're saying. Is that right?
That is right.
Okay. And what he wants to do is take them out of the, lead them from the Mosaic covenant into the new covenant.
He wants to take them into the new.
Yeah. Now, the Mosaic is not the same as the Sinaitic, though.
Well, it's not. It's different. The big difference with it is that God is going to write the laws in their hearts and in their minds, and God himself is going to cause them to keep those laws. And they will not have to be taught anymore because all men will know what the laws of God are. So there's some big differences in that regard. It's God doing the work as opposed to Israel trying to do the work.
They still would have had to have the priests.
They'd still have the priests, and that's mostly for the benefit of the nations, really.
And that the nation of Israel was supposed to be
the priesthood. Yep. That's correct. Then he would have done so. But he can't even begin to address those things because they never get to that point. Right. Almost like what in Leviticus 26, if you read that, you have those five cycles of judgment that are in chapter 26 of Leviticus. The last cycle of judgment can't end until there's a national confession. When that national confession comes, then God said that he would accomplish what he set out to do with Israel. They've never allowed that national confession to ever take place, though. It's never happened. It's happened on small scales, but it's never been a complete national thing. It will be a complete national thing when they look upon him whom they've pierced. Then the nation will go in the mourning. Then God will be able to usher in some things with them. But it hasn't happened yet.
They're just like Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, they're doing it their way, yeah. In fact, that would be their theme song.
100th birthday.
Yeah. So, I believe what you have in Joshua chapter 24 would be like what the preamble to the new covenant would look like. And it's interesting because if you go into Jeremiah 31, Israel's lamenting and thinking that all is hopeless and they're broken. And then he gets into the discussion of, then I will pour out, and he gets into the idea of pouring out blessings upon them in the new covenant and his spirit and so
on the way to Babylon and chains.
Yeah.
With the Jeremiah walking alongside of them.
That's right.
That's the last cycle of discipline.
And it's the beginning. It's the beginning of the last cycle.
We had national repentance at that point, and then the new covenant.
Yep, the last cycle of judgment is the Judean captivity. So when you look at that, that's what's going on. And they could have avoided that back there in Joshua. So, interesting stuff, I think. But, so next week we'll pick up with the last three ideas, looking at these three chapters. So, for homework, just kind of read through, Joshua 20. I'll give you a weird assignment for studying Exodus. Just read through chapter 24 of Joshua.
Not the whole book of Deuteronomy?
Well, if you want to, you can. If you want to read the whole book of Deuteronomy and the rest of the book of Exodus,
chapter
24
and chapter 24.
Up through chapter 24. You know, just chapter 20, the 24 of Exodus, and Joshua chapter 20, 24. Okay. What day special for you? Whatever day special for you.
Wednesday or Thursday? Or maybe even Tuesday?
What?
What about your calendar?
I can't do it.
How about Thursday? That works good for me.
Oh, here Wednesday, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could do Wednesday, but it's tough because I have to take
Tuesday. It is.
All works.
Thursday next week, go wild.
That sounds good.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good night, guys. Thank you.